Brilliant Friend, written by the mysterious Italian writer Lena Ferranti, is a blistering, endlessly compelling novel about the intense rivalry and friendship between two girls, Elena the narrator and Leela the brilliant friend of the title, as they grow up in a poor Neapolitan town in the 1950s. Published in 2011 with an English translation by Anna Goldstein in 2012, it has become a huge bestseller in Europe and America, as well as a slow but steady following here in Australia. It is the first in a quartet of novels on the lives of Elena and Leela, and in our discussion of Half of Yellow Sun, we would mention that we're going to review this book, and in fact, we would probably review all four of these books across the year. So we love this book so much. Snark is going to take a bit of a holiday this week, precisely because I'm in love. And my first question was, Gabby, how did you find out about the book and what had drawn you to it?
Well, the blessed internet doth provide. I was lying awake in bed one night in London. I woke up in the morning. I just remember being in a daze and opening Facebook and scrolling through. And there was this article in my news feed called Italy's Great Mysterious Storyteller. And it was in the New York Review of Books. It's by a writer called Rachel Durario. And I was like, okay, I'll open this. And I lay there reading it. And, like, every one of my, like, excitement triggers were there. Feminism, class issues, women writers, love stories, troubling friendship, intellectualism, questions of what is art. Yeah. Like, that's for me, like, ding, 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 ding. I knew I had to get my hands on this book straight away. I marched to the bookshop. I picked up My Brilliant Friend. I read that and the two other books in what was then a trilogy in the space of a week and a half. some of it I was reading in Italy itself. Then I went around to every person I met and grabbed them by the shoulders and said, have you read this book? Yeah. Have you read this book?
Yeah.
And I have remained slightly obsessed till this point.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, I think it was just, I just started reading and hearing so many things about it. I love podcasts, and I know that Slate, their audiobook club, they did a whole episode about that. I'm like, oh, okay. And then The New Yorker did one about the mysterious Elena Ferrante, and I'm like, okay, maybe I should read this. And we had a book club, and naturally the question is, what should we read next? And I'm like, I've heard this book, it sounds kind of interesting, let's do My Brilliant Friend. I had a friend who's Italian, so I'm like, maybe she can give us insight about that.
As I recall, actually, you asked me, because you were looking for something to talk about in the book club.
Oh, that's right.
And I said, I've just read this book, and please read it, and we must talk about it.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. Yes, it came from you.
I am the genesis behind this.
I know. I think about all the books that I've read over the past 4 months, and I think they all come from you pretty much.
No. I mean, most of the books that I've read over the last 4 months have come from you too, so it goes both ways.
So we did this book club, and it was amazing. I think generally we're pretty good at the book club. We have get to usually talk 45 minutes to an hour about a book, and I think that's a successful book club. There's a whole joke in The Vicar of Dibley where they're trying to read On Beauty by Zadie Smith, and it turns out everybody has just read the back cover. And so in the end, they have a heated discussion about not On Beauty, but a book about Winnie the Pooh. But yeah, we spent 3 hours talking about this book, and I think we could have spent the whole night talking about this book.
Well, I hope today if we can do justice to that famous book club that I was not in attendance at.
You were in Italy.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, you were living.
I was busy eating cannoli. Yeah. Okay, well, for both of us, for this podcast, we reread the book. And it's a really interesting process, rereading.
Yeah.
So what was your first impression of the novel? And now, as a rereader, did it enhance the book for you? Or did it make you like some things more or less?
Well, it was really interesting because in many ways, it didn't change at all. I thought, I was a bit worried that maybe the power of the book would lessen because you know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But I mean, the most vivid thing in the book for me is the tragedy of Leela's life.
Yeah.
And that still was the most apparent thing to me. In fact, it was even in larger, the second time I had read it. But I've only read the second novel, so I haven't read three and four. So, and I know you have read it. So you...
I am suppressing all of my desires to talk about the end of the novel.
Right.
Like,
I'm halfway in book three. So I'm definitely going to take it up again. But yeah, in many ways, it didn't change at all. I guess now I see even more with a sense of dread the things that I thought like were horrible are actually not that horrible in the context of things that happen later.
Yeah.
And but you know, to me, the power of the book, and obviously to Elena, the character, is the figure of Leela. And to me, she was just as transfixing the second time I read it. How about you?
I found it... Well, when I first read the books, there was this quickness to it, this pace that I couldn't control.
Yeah.
Like, it was just this act of consumption, reading these novels.
Yeah.
But this time, I didn't feel that. I felt it was still very powerful, but I took it a lot slower because I knew the tragedy that was lying and I couldn't keep reading in the hope that things would get better because I knew the tragedy that was behind every corner.
Yeah.
And for me, it was like almost a painful masochistic experience because as I was reading, I was like, oh God, I know what's going to happen next. No. And you read it in the hope that it's going to be different this time, but it's just the painfulness of it is too much to bear.
Yeah.
So to put into context for our listeners, the two friends become divided at the beginning, at the end of primary school, because whilst Lena's family decide to put up the money to send her to middle school, Leela's family totally refuse, and both of these girls are growing up in poverty-stricken Naples. So Leela's chances and hopes of fulfilling her destiny as a genius, they're just totally destroyed, and seeing... Yeah, the awfulness that comes out of that family's decision to keep back. And I guess, you know, this is set in 1950s Naples, so that's the convention of the time, right?
Yeah.
And how were they to know that they were destroying their daughter's lives as so many parents?
Well, I don't think... I think her parents can't even read.
Yeah.
Like, Nunzia especially, I think.
Yeah.
Just couldn't read. So as much as we sort of railed at the tragedy of this and the sheer waste of the choice not to send Leela to school, how would they know? They have no conception of what this genius
was. What the real tragedy is the lives of so many women around them who also did not have any opportunities at all. And Elena has the gift of education, and she's able to go forward in her lives and move beyond the boundaries of this neighborhood that the two girls feel confines them. And whilst Leela doesn't find freedom in the confinement, she's able to recreate her boundaries within that confinement. Leena is always striving onwards. Oh, I've noticed that we keep calling people different names. So Elena, the protagonist who writes in first person, she goes by Elena, Linu, what else?
I think that's
it. Yeah. While Leela, her name is Raffaella.
Yeah.
And she's goes by Leela and Lena. So...
And I think Elena makes a point that if she ever called Leela by Raffaella, they would know that their friendship would be dead.
Yes, yeah.
So it's very interesting, the power of names in this book.
Indeed.
And the repetition of names through generations is very important.
It's almost like something about destiny and how the name creates identity and destiny, or how you create somebody through the name that you give them.
Yeah.
Mm. So there's a lot of kind of like almost authorial power over different individuals through the naming.
The sort of authorial power over every character that Lena writes about as well. That's also an element.
Yeah, because, I mean, as you read the book, she's always like, in a way, vacillating between her sense of powerlessness, her impotence as a figure in this community, but also the power that she has through becoming a writer and being educated. But ultimately, you remember, as the reader, she has complete power over you.
Yeah.
And she has power over all of her characters, and she can construct this world in whatever way that she wants.
And this book is her active power over Leela.
Yes, that is true.
Because it's not a spoiler, at the beginning of the book, when these women are, 50?
66.
60? It is found out that Leela has disappeared. She has eroded every memory of her, every physical...
She even cuts her face out of all the photographs.
Yes. And Elena doesn't want this. And she's so angry. And so her act of writing the story of their lives becomes the act of revenge.
Yeah. Yes.
Because Leela wants to erase herself forever. And by writing about her, Elena prevents her from achieving that.
Yeah, so she was expanding the concept of trace all out of proportion. She wanted not only to disappear herself now at the age of 66, but also to eliminate the entire life that she had left behind. I was really angry. We'll see who'll win this time, I said to myself. I turned on the computer and began to write all the details of our story, everything that still remained in my memory.
So powerful. Yeah. And it's such a brilliant beginning to a book.
Yes.
I just...
But what... Oh, it kind of, like, raises a question for me about emotion and the sense of anger. Yeah. So I told my mom to read this book.
Yeah.
And she did. And she finished it and she said to me, I can't read the second one. And I was like, why is that? She's like, the sense of rage pulls you in so strongly that she wanted to kill all the characters. And she was so frustrated she could not move beyond it.
Yeah.
Did you get that sense when you were reading the book?
We'll come back again when we talk about the writing and what, if at all we can encapsulate the sort of the beauty and the strength of Elena Ferrante as a writer. Yeah. But the one thing that I would say about her writing is that it's infused with rage.
Yeah. I mean, isn't there, there's this one review in the back that says, imagine if Jane Austen got angry, and you'll have some idea of how explosive these works are, from John Freeman at The Australian.
Which is kind of funny, because there's a certain way you can read Jane Austen's works in a sense that it is, there is anger in there.
I mean, Freeman clearly hasn't read Jane Austen properly.
Yeah, I know. So if you can imagine that times 100, that's what Elena Ferrante
There's a sense of, like, not only revenge on Lila, but there is a greater revenge on men in general, and this is and Naples and society, and that's something that gets explored in the later novels.
Yeah.
But there definitely seems to be this desire to, like, take back everything that was taken from these young women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the crux of the novel is this intense friendship between Lila and Eleanor, and I thought maybe we could expand on that, because it's a very interesting relationship, and a lot of the people who have read this book, they love this book because they feel it's much more a realistic portrait of the own dynamics of their friends, or at least it comes to the fore the contradictions of a female friendship, that it's not necessarily like Sex in the City.
Well, I think firstly this is the first novel, I mean, like, the first, novel's too weak of a word, the first important novel, I mean, all novels are important, what's the word I'm looking for, the first...
Seminal?
That's a good word, the first seminal novel that actually treats female friendship in the way that male friendship has been treated over time immemorial. And usually we have female relationships in through the context of sisters.
Yes.
But female friendship in this really... like, destructive, like, actually very ugly. These two girls, they're brilliant, but both of them are hideous individuals.
Yeah.
And one could say, well, that's maybe because of the neighborhood that forced them into it, whatever. But to see two women treated in a way that's, like, not clean, that's not been covered in iodine in order to, like, take away anything unsightly or unseemly about it. And maybe that extends to the novel as a whole. It's representation of bodies, and bodies, like, are so full of life. I mean, that's part of the pun. But in this novel, you see bodies of all their grossness. They are not, nice things in Ferrante's Naples.
Things erupt as opposed to, like, develop.
Yes.
She describes pustules forming in one's face.
And legs limping and bodies just not working. But back to friendship, I guess, like, did you have a Lila growing up? Let's just think about that question, for example. Sorry, before you answer. Yeah. It's so interesting that this question is framed as, do you have a Lila? Like, you identify with Elena, the protagonist. But for Lila, Lila's Elena.
Yeah.
And it's just so interesting that, like... Anyway, we'll get back there at the end.
Yeah.
The question of who is the brilliant friend. But did you have a Lila?
I would say in many ways a lot of my relationships with women are this type of friend. Not, I mean, as violent and as, like, intense and destructive. But I think to any extent you see, because women around you are the mirror images of yourself, seeing when other women are successful, it comes to mind your own inadequacies.
Yeah, but that's because of the patriarchy and this idea that another woman's success is your failure.
Yeah.
Like, this competition between women that's always created in women's relationships.
Yeah, and it's sort of like the two poles of, like, career and having a family as well. It can get very complicated. But yeah, I would say that I I can think of a couple of people who I would say I am the Elena to their Leela. And I assume in some ways it would be vice versa.
Yes, indeed. How about you? Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think of the intense relationships that I've had with women and my deep admiration and respect, but also my envy, and how my envy of them spurred me on to do more.
Yeah.
And how that, in some, it's a sickness that pervades the friendship, actually.
Well, I think that's when you become an adult. That's what friendships become.
Well,
do you think
that's depressing? No, I think
Well, I mean, I guess you can think of adult relationships come with an adult mind.
Yes.
And an adult mind has so much more sort of like dysfunction than a child's mind. Like if you think of the friendships that you had as a child. But
I think it's also something to do with like human nature wanting what we can't have.
Yeah.
And we see this through Elena's eyes, wanting what Lila has.
Yeah.
But then we never really think about it from the other side. Yeah, because Lila wants what Elena has.
Yeah.
Lila would probably give away everything if she could have had Elena's luck and having a father that decides to give her an education.
Yeah.
Because he has, I don't know, do you think it was in the end a financial decision? Or a value decision?
To not send Lila to school? It was probably both. It's just like, I mean, the machismo of the culture, this notion that a woman could do something that could not be, they would not give to their son.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is a distinction as well that Elena's father as a porter is still at a higher level than the local shoemaker.
Yeah, yeah.
There's still a distinction,
yeah.
a minuscule one,
yeah.
but it's still an important distinction, and ultimately that's the difference between Leela and Leela's father. Well, I mean, class pervades this novel, and in many ways, the sort of inadequacy and impotence that Elena feels and all the men in the neighborhood feel comes from an inadequacy that they feel in terms of class. So a lot is drawn about the town that they live, this Neapolitan town, and when they sometimes go out of town into the city, there's this distinct sense of like dread because you know they're going to come to face with their biggest fears.
Yeah.
And there's this great sense of distinction between Neapolitan language and dialect and Roman language and dialect.
Yes, yes.
That's really important.
And different characters in the... Well, Lila and Elena use Italian as a way to assert control.
Yes.
Italian being different from Neapolitan dialect.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's this paragraph on the third last page of the novel where Lila is describing... Elena is describing her anguish, her fear that she's never going to escape the neighborhood.
Mm.
I discovered that I considered the publication of those few lines, my name in print, as a sign that I really had a destiny, that the hard work of school would surely lead upward, somewhere that Maestro Olivio had been right to push me forward and to abandon Lila. Do you know what the plebs are? Yes, Maestro. At that point, I knew what the plebs were, much more clearly than when, years earlier, she asked me. The plebs were us. The plebs were that fight for food and wine, that quarrel over who should be served first and better, the dirty floor on which the waiters clattered back and forth, those increasingly vulgar toasts. The plebs were my mother, who had drunk wine and was now leaning against my father's shoulder, while he, serious, laughed, his mouth gaping at the sexual illusions of the metal dealer. They were all laughing, even Lila, at the expression of one who has a role and who will play it to the utmost.
It's terrible and... Yet so palpable as well. In this section, it also reminds us of the figure of Maestro Oliviero, who is a sort of kind of an intrinsic part of this narrative in the sense that...
She's almost like the fairy godmother gone very wrong. Yeah. Anyway, I interrupted you.
No. She is. She's this fairy godmother. And so early on, Lila becomes Maestro Oliviero's favorite student. But because her father refuses to send her to middle school, Maestro Oliviero becomes very cold to Lila.
Yeah.
And Lila writes a book called The Blue Fairy when they're like, 8 years old or something like that. And instead of reacting in the way that you would think a teacher would when encountering a brilliant book written by a little girl, she becomes incredibly cold and distant. And it really is the turning point. I mean, you have this idea that if Maestro Oliviero somehow took Lila on her side and campaigned for her, that maybe Lila's life would be very, very different. But she chooses not to. I don't know exactly the reasons why, but I think intrinsically it comes to class.
Yes, yeah, it does. That at one point, when the girls are teenagers, and Elena still has a relationship with the maestra. Yeah. The maestra says to Elena, "The beauty of mind that Cirullo had from childhood didn't find an outlet, Greco, and it has all ended up in her face, her breasts, in her thighs, and her ass, places where it soon fades, and it will be as if she never had it." Yeah.
Well, it's maybe also it's the sort of existential worldview of Maestra Olivier. She feels a sense of inevitability of Lila's life, that if she didn't have that sense, then maybe Lila's life would be very different.
Well, I think that's a good way to open up conversations about the nature of fate in this novel.
Yeah.
And destiny, and this all links back to class, right? If you're born in a lower class, is your destiny that you will never leave it?
Yeah.
I mean, because that's... But for maybe for the teacher, she, in her view, her parents... Lila's parents' decision not to, or their lack of intelligence, I guess, in taking Lila outside of their, like, giving her the opportunity to move beyond their class, that is something that forever demarcated them into that area.
Yeah.
And because of that, they are not worthy of moving upwards. Yeah. And then the maestro's fixation on Elena and deciding to put all her energy into her is because she, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting if we think of it through the maestro's, her own life, she would have tried. She is a teacher, so that means she left the lower class group. So she is like these girls herself, in a way. And maybe she, I don't know, I can't explain it. I can't explain the absolute hatred that she has of Lila. Yeah. But yeah, fate and destiny. How much of that is a central part of the novel, do you think?
I think it's from the very beginning, it gives this almost fairy tale-ish, sort of mythic sense of these... of these human beings. I mean, the idea of these two friends to spur them, both of them, into more dangerous territory, even as a little girl, like throwing their dolls into Don Achille, who is this sort of ogre boogeyman figure.
Yeah, he's the ogre.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a fabulous article in M+1 magazine called Those Like Us by a writer called Dana Tortorini. And she writes about the myths and types that are present in all of Ferrante's work. So you have the poverella, and the poverella is like the impoverished woman, the disturbed impoverished woman. The educated young woman, you have the missing doll, you have the short, stocky man who has control over women's lives, and how these are figures, the disfigured mother also. These are figures that go through all of Ferrante's books.
Yeah.
So types and destiny and fairy tale types are very, very important for our novels.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I think are really interesting, well, there's two genres that I feel like this book kind of inverts. The first is a buildings Roman in the style of Little Women or Anne of Green Gables, about this young, smart, talented woman who emerges from poverty or a lack of resources and becomes a writer and artist. And then the second is the marriage plot, which is kind of, I mean, the one constant narrative is that Cinderella, your least favourite fairy tale, which is the notion of this impoverished woman coming to her own through marriage to a wealthy man.
Yeah.
And that, and I mean, like, in romance novels and most of, to be honest, most of women's literature, that is the prevailing...
That's a woman's life.
And so this book is kind of, in a way, you can sort of think it's an inversion of that fairy tale.
Yeah.
And it, I mean, you even have this idea of, like, Elena's father as a shoemaker.
Yes.
That's such, like, a Grimm-like detail.
Yes, it is indeed, Well, it's interesting that also, if you think about it that way, how Elena's father is a porter, and that's someone that takes to the other world. He's like, who is the boatman on the River Styx?
Oh, he can never leave the boat.
Yes.
I know, but I can't.
What is his name? Oh, that's going to irritate me. Whatever. Anyway, so I think destiny and myth is integral to understanding the novel. And even Elena's name, Elena Greco, translates to Helen the Creek. And that has Greekness and storytelling and myth, of course, as links with Homer's Odyssey, right? And how Homer is the great myth maker and story maker of the Western world and male identity.
But he's not, like, we tend to think of him as the singular figure, but actually Homer was, like, an amalgamation of different voices.
Yeah.
So it kind of, another divergence again, but the notion of the writer and your point about collaboration.
Yeah.
in the novel.
Yes.
And how that works in the creation of art. Arguably, the point of the novel is that one voice does not necessarily an artwork make.
Yes.
That it's often the combination,
yes,
of two voices in unison that,
yeah,
creates things.
Yes, indeed. And Elena at one point talks about that. She says, so Elena at one point writes an essay about Dido, and she gets her inspiration from talking to Lilla, and Lilla and her have this discursive, beautiful conversation that we never see most of their conversations, by the way. We're only left to imagine it, and it's...
Well, we never hear Lila's voice.
Yes.
That's
her narrative voice.
Yeah, her narrative voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lena writes scores and scores,
yeah,
and scores about how brilliant Lila's voice,
yeah,
is. But we never hear it.
No, we never do. Elena has a lot of insecurities about the fact that she feels that this essay isn't hers. It's not truly hers, that Lila was the one that created it. And she says, "Of course," I said to myself, "the essay on Dido is mine. The capacity to form their beautiful sentences comes from me. Of course, what I wrote about Dido belongs to me. But didn't I work it out with her? Didn't we excite each other in turn? Didn't my passion grow in the warmth of hers? And that idea of the city without love, which the teachers like so much, hadn't it come to me from Lila? Even if I had developed it with my own ability, what should I deduce from this?" So for Elena, she doesn't seem to realize that the best art comes from collaboration. You need somebody to bounce your ideas off. And the whole conflict that she has in her identity, actually, in her identity as a writer in the later books, comes from her realization that she needs Lila to write. And it's like she needs Lila to exist,
yeah,
even. She self-identifies through bouncing off her identity off an archetype,
yeah,
which is Lila. And
it's a powerful, yeah, it's a powerful notion. And I mean, I feel like we always talk about the canon,
yeah,
every week, but I know it's an important part of what you are trying to do in your PhD.
Yeah.
About trying to erode the notion of this monolithic artist.
Yeah.
One singular figure.
Yes.
And I think that this book is a powerful antidote,
yeah,
to that myth.
I mean, there are conspiracy theories that Elena Ferrante, which is a pseudonym, is multiple artists. I don't believe that, because
no,
there's one very sustained narrative voice,
yeah,
and I don't think that could be maintained,
yeah,
through, like, you'd be able to tell. So I think maybe Elena's greatest problem is her inability to accept that there is somebody as great as her out there. And maybe that's Lila's problem too, because Lila has to, at several times in the novel, at several points in the novel, attempts to destroy Elena's hopes and dreams and kind of intellectually one-ups her. Like in the part, for example, when Lila convinces Elena to go with her on this long walk to find the ocean. And she does it. This brilliant 7-year-old girl,
yeah,
comes up with this idea because she thinks Elena will be in so much trouble,
mm-hmm,
that she won't know she's 7, like 12 or whatever,
yeah,
that she won't be allowed to go on, her parents will forbid her from going to school.
Yeah.
And there's this other point in the novel where Elena starts learning Greek and ancient Greek in middle school. And Lila takes it upon herself to learn ancient Greek and outwits Elena in public. There's a scene where they're at a dance and Lila's like, "Do you know what a gramophone, where the word gramophone comes from?" And Lila's like, "No." And Lila's like, "It's Greek." And this comes in the context of Elena being, you know, and probably boasting about the fact that she's learning ancient,
yeah,
Greek. And it comes Elena's greatest insecurity that in the end she is no more than her friendship with Lila.
Yes, well, I mean, another example is Lila at the point in time when she's young and tries to teach herself all the things that Elena's learning at school,
yeah,
and she borrows all these books from the library,
yeah,
and then at one point she just stops, she,
yeah,
loses interest, and Elena comes to the library and the librarian says, "Oh, Lila has stopped borrowing books," and Elena immediately gets this complex from it,
yeah,
this idea that to this librarian, everybody is all the same except for Lila.
Yeah.
And so Elena is always worried that her form will be entirely subsumed,
yeah,
by Lila's.
Yeah.
Just as a force of nature.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. And I mean, this goes back to, like, we just touched upon the whole friendship in the novel, and I guess that conversation set us back there.
Yeah.
But this whole idea of the intimacy between them and the sexual the sexual element?
I think so. Well, I mean, the most vivid and most amazing paragraph to me in the book is when Elena is washing Leela's body right. before Leela gets married.
Yes. But what about it is so powerful?
Well, because...
Let's do some hardcore literary analysis right here, right now.
Well, I mean, because it's the first time that Elena has seen Leela naked.
Yeah.
And this notion astounds her. And she talks about this untouched body that she uses in a few hours before Stefano touched her, penetrated her, disfigured her, perhaps by making her pregnant.
Yeah.
And then she talks about the childish shoulders on the breasts and the cold, stiffly cold nipples on the narrow hips and tense buttocks on the black sex. And and then she says... She calls, she says your heart, but she's really talking about her heart is agitated, your veins inflamed. Mm. And that type of imagery, it sounds like a lover admiring his lover's body.
Yeah.
And it's the genius of Ferranti's writing.
Yeah.
Like, she can switch on this element that has been kind of, you know, simmering throughout this whole book and then brings it to the fore. And it completely changes your notion of this book and this friendship.
Like the intense sexual competition between the two.
Yeah.
And the only way for Elena to really know Leela or understand Leela is to experience the exact same things as her. And she says here, and it suddenly seemed to me that the only remedy against the pain I was feeling that I would feel was to find a corner secluded enough so that Antonio could do to me at the same time the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I just told you about losing her virginity.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that the kind of sexual element that you would think that our first intuition is that she wants to sleep with Leela.
Yeah.
She doesn't, that's not her inclination. It's more that she wants to experience as Lila's experience.
Maybe it's kind of this idea of Plato's idea of love and the idea that we, before we were walking the earth as two bodies fused into one.
Yes,
and then we were separated.
Yeah.
And the story of love is coming to find our soulmate.
Yes.
The bodies coming together. And in that platonic sense of love, maybe that's what Leela wants. Elena wants.
Yeah.
She and Leela to come together as one.
Mm.
So it's not a sexual love.
You know what that reminds me of? Also, it reminds me of...
Yes, thanks.
It reminds me of... early modern, so 17th century writings, and also ancient Roman.
Yeah.
The early modern writings come from the Roman writings.
Yeah.
On male friendship, and this idea that male friendship is this perfect coupling of two individuals that happen to be separate but the same person.
Yeah.
And how no romantic love can supplement the pure love of that's part of male friendship.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten the Latin word. It's just very interesting how Ferrante is usurping these male ideas about friendship to talk about women.
Yeah.
Which is so
remarkable.
Yeah.
So what do you think of their relationship? Or is it just, we just accept it as the complexities of
friendship? Do I think it's real?
Yeah.
Or it could be real?
Yeah.
Well, or is it romantic? I think that passage is imbued with a lot of sexual energy.
Yeah.
But I think Elena, for a lot of this novel, she fixates upon Leela's form and her beauty, and how Leela, out of this gangly, awkward girl who she describes in her youth being like a salted anchovy, becomes this Jackie Kennedy-esque, young supermodel kind of type. And Elena is suffused with jealousy and sexual jealousy over Leela. But I think that's more representative of her own sense of lack.
Yeah.
And I think, at one point Leela says to Elena, "You are the pretty one."
Well, it moves on to another discussion that we'll probably have about masculinity.
Yes.
Machismo culture. And a lot of the violence, the extreme violence comes from an impotence.
Yes.
And an inadequacy. And this idea of Elena being transfixed, of disfiguring Elena.
Yeah.
That sort of men wanting to destroy women in order to have ownership. Maybe that's the same sort of force that drives Elena.
Yes. Yes, it's interesting.
So do you want to talk about masculinity?
Yes.
Yeah. That's such an extreme and often a source of rage.
Yes.
That is in the book.
Yes. So violence is something that's key to the girls growing up. It's just like a basic part of their existence. One passage in the novel that describes violence. At the bar Sorolla, in the heat between gambling losses and troublesome drunkenness, people often reach the point of disperazione, a word that in dialect meant having lost all hope, but also being broke, and hence of fights. Silvio Solara, the owner, a large man with an imposing belly, blue eyes and a high forehead, had a dark stick behind the bar with which he didn't hesitate to strike at anyone who didn't pay for drinks, who had asked for a loan and didn't repay it within the time limit. He made any sort of agreement and didn't keep it. And often he was helped by his sons, Marcello and Michelle, both of the boys the age of Lilla's brother, who hit harder than their father. Blows were given and received. Men returned home embittered by their losses, by alcohol, by debts, by deadlines, by beatings. And the first inopportune word, they beat their families, a chain of wrongs that generated wrongs.
Yeah, it feels very primal and primordial, and it goes on to your point about how this is a book about myths, because it's kind of, this is not a masculine behavior that you and I encounter.
Yes.
But in some ways, the behavior that is experienced by women today is kind of like a cultivation, a more genteel version of the violence that these women experience.
Yeah, and I thought about that later. I didn't mark the page earlier, but I was thinking about the violence of the physical violence is later transmuted into verbal violence.
Yeah.
Other kinds of harassments, like Elena is harassed by the father,
and
she's
molested.
Yeah, by a man, by the father of a boy that she happens to be in love with. The boy is Nino Sartori. The father is Donato Sartori, who at first she admires because he's the only person in the neighborhood that one left it and two is a writer.
Yeah.
But Donato won't leave her alone. He sexually abuses her at one point in the novel. And it made me think about the fact that even if he doesn't use physical violence, he does in one sense, but even later in his harassments, even if he doesn't use physical violence itself, it's a verbal violence.
Yeah.
And he takes poetry and he's like, I wrote you these poems, let me read them to you. And it takes art and turns into a type of violence.
Yeah.
And maybe, like, and I think, like, at what point is Elena's revenge on Lilla using art as a type of violence?
Yeah. Some novels by men are often just an act of violence in the women that betray them.
Yeah, yeah.
And it makes me recall, you know, in the end of Persuasion, when Anne is talking to one of Captain Winslow's friends and he says, like, all the acts of wrong have been committed by women to men, and she's like, no, it's only because men are the only ones who can write about them.
Yeah.
And so it goes to your idea of, like, the idea of men using art or using words to control but also disfigure women's identities.
Yes, exactly. And I think what's so interesting about these novels and why there's such a cult following behind them is that Ferrante is taking on the voice of the male writer, and she's usurping the domain of men, which is myth and storytelling, and she's becoming the myth maker herself. And there's this great talk by Mary Beard, which I was telling you about earlier. You can find it on the London Review of Books website.
I'm totally going to listen to it.
And it's about from the beginning of Western society, starting with Homer's Iliad. It's the story begins with Odysseus' son telling his mother, or this is in the Odyssey, not the Iliad. Odysseus telling his mother, you be silent. Mythos. He uses the word, the Greek word mythos, which is about telling stories, which is different to the Greek word for like chit chat.
Yeah.
So, or telling stories and politics. It is the domain of men.
Yeah.
You return to your room. And from the very beginning of the get-go of the Western canon, men's stories are about telling women to shut up.
Yeah.
And now here we have this woman who usurps myth, who's always like making allusions to Greek myth. Like she talks a lot about Dido and Aeneas. And it's just showing, women in a complete like lack of control. And there's, if it's like these girls are Didos on the funeral pyre and they're going to go down in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
Like their lives are absolutely terrible, but they are going to destroy as much around them as they possibly can. So you have this very real vision of like, well, not real, I mean this very tortured version of women's lives. but also this beauty of art behind it, that a woman is creating it.
Yeah.
And that she is the, I guess, she is the Homer.
Yeah.
And she's using Elena Greco and this idea of Greekness in order to, like, I don't know, it's just interesting how, like, Homer is, like, refracted throughout the whole novel, and myth is refracted throughout the whole novel, and, yeah, that's my little spiel. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's incredibly fascinating, and I think that is the power of this book, and, yeah. You know, my last question is basically, in Half a Young Son, yeah. We're talking about that book's place in, like, what we presume is its literary history,
yeah.
And whether it was worth Bailey or Bailey's, and we pointed out that this book was ultimately, we loved this book more than that book, and I think what your point really goes to the heart of it, because it feels really transgressive in every aspect.
Yeah.
In the things that I was interested in growing up as a girl, the marriage plot and discovery of Bildungsroman and the discovery of women developing a life outside of the domestic.
Yeah.
And it upends that.
Yes.
And it upends female friendships.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so transfixing.
Yeah, and it's just, this novel is written in a way, I love the kind of, the cumulative sentences, like this novel is such a sense of, like, movement, because she writes in, like, her sentences have this, like, listing quality that I wrote down an example somewhere. You're always pushed along.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, in the excerpt that we read out at the beginning, actually, there's a lot of listing in that one. Yeah. She has this ability to write in, like, these never-ending sentences, like, on the narrow hips and the tense buttocks, on the black sex, on the long legs, on the tender knees, on the curved ankles, on the elegant feet. Like,
yeah. Becomes this almost blank verse type of reading that compels you.
Yeah, and I remember a few weeks back, months back even, we had a discussion, when we were talking about Half the Yellow Sun, we were talking about how we both prefer books that have more elegant and metaphorical verse. Oh, sorry, wrong word.
Yeah.
This prose is not elegant.
No.
Why do we love it so much then, if it's not like anything else that is usually within our taste level?
I'm just trying to find the things.
Yeah.
But, like, anything that Elena says about Leela's writing, I almost feel could describe Elena Ferrante's writing.
Right.
So,
I understood what, at the time, I'd liked so much. There was, in The Blue Fairy, the same quality that struck me now. Leela was able to speak through writing, unlike me when I wrote, unlike Sarah Torrey in his articles and poems, unlike even in many writers I had read and was reading. She expressed herself in sentences that were well constructed and without error, even though she had stopped going to school, but further, she left no trace of effort. You weren't aware of the artifice of the written word. I read and I saw her, I heard her. The voice and the writing overwhelmed me, enthralled me even more than when we talked face to face. It was completely cleansed of the dross of speech, of the confusion of the oral. It had the vivid orderliness that I imagine would belong to the conversations if one was so fortunate as to be born from the head of Zeus, and not from the Grecos, the Cerulos. I was ashamed of the childish pages I had written to her, the overwrought tone, the frivolity, the false cheer, the false grief. Who knows what Leela had thought of me?
Yeah, so, I mean, as we could go on and on about the beauty of Ferrante's prose.
Yeah.
And it's an unornamental beauty as well. But I feel like she expresses it herself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's writing without the dross.
Yes, but it's also so impassioned.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons people read these books so quickly is because of the momentum of it.
Yeah. Well, it's so brilliantly structured.
Yes.
Because it starts with the beginning where you find out this is in the future and Leela has left, and it's such a brilliant beginning.
Yeah.
And then she ends it in such a brilliant way.
Yes, with the cliffhanger and
of the shoes and the wedding that are being worn by Solara. These shoes the shoes are like are the symbol of Stefano's presumed love for Leela, and it's the symbol has been given to Solara, a complete corruption of that love.
Yes,
and it's just. It was so suspenseful that I had to immediately read the second book to find out what happened.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of her brilliance.
Yes, indeed. Well, my talk about brilliance, I guess the question to end this conversation, who is the brilliant friend?
Yeah.
On the night before the wedding, Leela, just before Elena's washing Leela, they have this conversation. She was silent for a while, staring at the water that sparkled in the tub. Then she said, "Whatever happens, you'll go on studying. 2 more years, then I'll get my diploma and I'm done. No, don't stop. I'll give you the money. You should keep studying." I gave a nervous laugh and said, "Thanks, but at a certain point, school is over. Not for you. You're my brilliant friend. You have to be the best of all, boys and girls." So for Lila, Elena's the brilliant friend. And that's the title of the novel.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think it's very interesting because it's before when we were talking about how Lila is Elena's mirror. And Lila is, in a way, the way that Elena defines herself. She's the other Elena.
Yeah.
And this whole book is a book about Lila, but it's also about Elena's self-discovery. Yeah. So in a way, she's using Lila in order to create herself.
Yeah.
So in a way, the title is like a My Brilliant Friend. She's talking about herself, possibly.
Yeah.
Because Lila is herself, or another side of herself.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see that, but I think it's my love of Lila.
Lila, on the face level, yes, she is the brilliant friend. She is clearly the genius out of the two of them.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, but you're right in the sense that Elena, I mean, the act of, ultimately, it's Elena who gets published. Elena who is the writer.
She's the one that leaves the neighborhood.
Yeah, she's the one who doesn't want to erase herself.
Yeah.
She's the one who's going to exist, you know, 25, 50 years on. And the notion of art as an act of courage as well is very important.
Yes, yeah.
And so in many ways, Elena is the courageous friend because she can write down and she can show all her warts and all. She is like, "I'm going to commit this.
Yeah.
I'm going to commit to writing this." And ultimately, Lila could have pushed herself out of this world, but ultimately she decides not to. And it's Elena, the one who actually who decides to emancipate herself from this stifling environment.
Yeah.
So maybe in some ways Elena is the brilliant friend.
Well, I guess you, dear listener, will have to find this out for yourself.
Yeah.
When you read this novel, you definitely should do.
Yes, definitely.